Good morning. I think this is working. We are right in the back of the mic. It sounds like it's not on full bore here yet. Are we okay up on the podium there on sound or no? Okay. Well, I could start by saying that things are so tough in the state of California, they don't even have staff to fix the clock back there. So you think we're broke, look at this clock back there. It's really broke. I don't know how that one is. No, that one's working. Well, we got one out of two. That's not bad. That's not helping. So before we get going, I normally have a little story, but this is a true story. Sometimes I embellish on some of my stories. Could you imagine that? But agencies get a lot of letters, and there's times we're a little slow at responding on letters. And this one here I will read, but I will leave a sentence or two out, and I'll add it at the end. It said, I'm very interested in, this is for the colonel also, the mothball fleet, because I believe it is a problem in California and will continue to be unless something can be done. Would you please send me information on the mothball fleet? I look forward to learning more about this issue. Thank you very much. Sincerely, Michael Winokur. Michael is a fourth grader at San Ramon Valley Christian Academy in Danville. And if I ask us to ever respond to a letter, let's respond to this. And as soon as we can, and I would even be willing to invite him to come and say a few words at the meeting. So
indeed, yeah.
I think if you want to talk about PR and good things, this guy's he's a future water board member.
There we go.
Or an activist, one or the other. Do you know this young man?
I don't know him, but I realize that he must be really, really smart, because look at the font he put this in.
Smart enough to make a large font.
She's picking up on this. She knows the age of this. He knows the age of this board, so I'm going to leave this with you guys.
Mr. Chairman, that'd make a good naval officer.
Probably better than a Marine anyway. But anyway, we better get going here.
So yeah, we may be able to arrange a ship on his front lawn, too. So.
That's right. I'm ready for this young man. So we'll go with roll call, please.
Mr. Eliago?
Here.
Mr. McGrath?
Here.
Mr. Moore?
Here.
Mr. Peacock?
Here.
Mr. Schroeder?
Here.
Dr. Singh? Dr. Dunn?
Here.
Mr. Bond?
Here. Introductions at this time, other than our state board member?
We have no introductions. I will note that Assistant Executive Officer Tom Lumley will not be with us. He had a death in the family, so he will not be today.
Our thoughts are with Tom's family. Tam, would you like to come forward and say a few words, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, board members, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for not asking me to bring good words from Sacramento like you usually do. Yes, I have finally convinced you that there are no good words from Sacramento. But there are a couple of things that I wanted to make you aware of. The last time I was here, I mentioned that we were expecting a final report from an independent performance audit that we requested of our underground storage tank cleanup fund, and that final report did arrive. And if you're interested in a copy, I'm sure Bruce can provide it to you, or I certainly will be happy to. It was a very good report, I thought. They did not pull any punches in terms of evaluating the underground storage tank cleanup fund, and obviously the state board's and all of ours management of that fund. Among the findings that they had were that we had inadequate financial management and planning practices in place, that we had lack of control functions and effective cost containment, and this one I'm sure will surprise you, that there are unclear roles and responsibilities and conflicting objectives between regulatory oversight agencies. Now that, of course, never happens anywhere. So I thought it was a pretty pretty blunt, pretty fair report. They provided a lot of recommendations, which obviously the staff is exploring. And in fact, our underground storage tank task force is actually meeting this afternoon to review the audit's recommendation and provide their responses and their recommendations on follow-up to the state board. There are various recommendations to report in terms of process streamlining, in terms of obviously cost control measures and putting in financial management practices, as well as quality control processes as well. So it's having the underground storage cleanup fund in this condition is obviously not something we ever wanted to happen or ever want to happen again. But on the positive side, I think it's provided us the opportunity to obviously bring in a lot of input from our stakeholders, from independent auditors, and hopefully position us for great improvements in the program. And in fact, the report basically bluntly said, unless we improve our practices, there's no way the fund can be sustainable. So it was a very good kick in the behind and a wake-up call for us, and we obviously will be following up on that. I also wanted to share with you our fees conditions. As you know, this time every year, we go through the process of, at least staff goes through the process, of trying to estimate what the fees would be for the upcoming year, and then they will eventually bring it to the state board for consideration later on this year. The state board staff met with fee stakeholders, I believe, a couple of weeks ago, and gave them the bad news. And the bad news is that we will be looking at pretty significant fee increases for this coming year. And a lot of it is due to the fact that the governor's proposed budget shifted a lot of our fees from general fund to fees. And another reason for the increase that staff is projecting is simply because we've been drawing down on our reserves all these years, and we no longer have a significant reserve. So staff is estimating, now these are just estimates, and of course it will change based on whatever the final budget is that is approved by the legislature and the governor, and obviously whatever fee structure that the state board finally approves. But for now, staff is proposing to our stakeholders that the stormwater fees be, well, we need to increase those fees by $2.4 million in order to meet our expenditures, our projected expenditures. And so that would be, staff estimates, a 13% fee increase. For our NPDES program, the governor's proposed budget shifted $1.6 million from general fund to fees, so that amount would need to be raised. And another aspect for us is land disposal, regulation of landfills. Typically, we draw money from the tipping fees that are collected by the waste board, which is now CalRecycle. But there's been a significant decrease in those funds. And so in order to fill that hole, the governor's proposed budget shifted $2.4 million from that tipping fee to the waste discharger permit fund. And so those fees would have to be increased in order to fill that hole. So not good news to be sharing with our stakeholders, obviously, in these economic times. But staff, say for staff, goes on the practice that we try to give our stakeholders as early a warning as possible as to what say for staff is looking at. And then obviously there will still be negotiations and discussion as we go forth. And then one final thing, the state board is very focused right now on Delta activities. It seems to be actually the majority of my time anyway. According to the Delta package that was approved by the legislature and by the governor, the state board is going to be holding later this month, actually in 2 weeks, hearings to set Delta flow criteria. And so we have tons and tons of reading materials to enjoy. And since I know there are some EB Mudd folks in the room, I will just have to say that my favorite comments that was submitted was from EB Mudd. It was essentially one page that says, while we reserve our rights, we're not participating at this time, not submitting any testimony or witnesses. Thank you. Also, on the Delta Fund, the State Board submitted to the, I believe it was Department of Personnel Administration, the paperwork to announce and fill the Delta Water Master position, for which the package also required the State Board to do. Pending approval by the Department of Personnel Administration. I believe we can do that hopefully within the next few months. And the package also, as you all know, required the administration and others to appoint members of the Delta Commission by July 1st. And from what I've heard, they seem to be on target to do that as well. So lots will be happening on Delta-related issue in the next few months. Thank you.
If there are any questions of State Board member, I will say this quickly, that at least there's one agency working in Sacramento. Thank you. Anyone else for comments? I'll be mentioning in my report regarding the WQCC with Board Member McGrath. I'm not sure, are we still looking at May 24th and 25th?
I will defer to Board Member McGrath on that since he's been involved.
Oh, we could do it in your report then, Board Member.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thanks, Tam. Good seeing you. Keep up the good work. Sorry about that. At this time, I have no cards for public forum, so we will move on. I don't think so. Let me check one more time. No. Minutes of the board meeting from September 9th, 2009. Motion to approve, please.
Move so.
Second.
Moved and second. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor, aye, please.
Aye.
So ordered. And quickly, I will do my best for my chair's report. Number one, I want to mention, I guess, since the last meeting, one of our valuable staff members, their city has won a number of awards. Is that correct?
El Cerrito.
El Cerrito. They've been in the news. And,
in a good way.
In a good way. And so Sandy's going to share all their knowledge and how they got all these grants and all that stuff with all the rest of us municipalities up here, Rob, myself. So thank you. Congratulations. And job well done. And you picked a good year because fortunately we're having some rain to see if those things will work. I did have a state chair's call this past week. And one of the things I wanted to mention with Tam is there was a discussion of a bill regarding the cleanup and abatement fund that they were thinking of cleaning out and putting over into general, but I don't know how far that's going to go. But there's a lot of interest in, as she said, with fees and everything else, and everyone's taking our money there. And the other one would be WQCC talked about it, and I guess you can fill us in on that at your report. And we were talking about Delta and anti-degradation also on their Board Member McGrath. And what else did I have here quickly? I found it interesting in the executive officer's report, and it's really a sign of the times where the Brownsfield work is being cut way back on because of the world economies and people's development projects and things like that. So that's really definitely a sign of the times. So I think that's all I have right now. Thank you. So we'll start right down there, Board Member Schroeder. Board Member Moore?
Just real briefly, I want to commend staff on the executive officer's report for this month. And I guess in terms of my backyard in Marin County, I just want to acknowledge the investment of staff time that it's taken to build trust in the Lagunitas Creek watershed. We also have the Guadalupe River update, where that kind of investment of staff time, I think, is really necessary because you have to overcome, and I know I work with people who live in these areas that are affected, and you have to overcome a mistrust of the local government there in terms of the plan review process and everything. A lot of war stories in terms of getting approval for simple things in your own backyard. And so I think it's a very good strategy that staff is employing, and management is allowing staff to have FaceTime with folks to build trust, because otherwise the goals we have to restore, the coho salmon complex habitat on private property is just going to fail miserably unless we have that kind of investment of time. You don't get a lot of credit for permits issued and things like that, but just wanted to encourage that kind of investment. and recognize the limitations we have with 15% of our time down under the current economic conditions. So we're accomplishing a lot, and I just want to encourage an ongoing investment. Thanks.
Board Member McGrath?
Kind of picking up on that, two things to report on. One is the Water Quality Coordinating Committee, and the other is a talk that I heard last night by Brian Kluwer of National Marine Fisheries Service. So I'll talk about that. They're actually tied together into what Board Member Moore said. We still have the 24th and the 25th of May reserved for the Water Quality Coordinating Committee. That depends on the logistics, including finalizing an agenda and the budget. Getting all the board members from all across the state together does require some money. Right now they're looking at about a day and a half. The three topics that I can remember involve enforcement and particularly using metrics to do that. I'm not a particular fan of another half day spent on enforcement, but I may not prevail on that. Policy development at the state board and possibly using trash as a forum for that. The difficulty with that is that's more applicable to urban areas than some of the boards, so not all the boards see that as terribly useful to them. And one of the clear items of consideration is more time board members splitting up the tables, so we're actually talking to the board members and not having staff talking to us. I mean, that seems to be a consistent thread. And then water policy, which I'm lobbying for. So let me turn to what I heard last night. The Water Resources Archives, which is the information arm of the University of California in the engineering field, sponsors a colloquium with different water subjects. And the faculty sponsors on that are Matt Condolf, who's a geomorphologist, and Jim Hunt, who most of you probably know from the sanitary engineering and environmental engineering side, both of whom I've known for many, many years. Last night they had Brian Kluwer, who's a fluvial geomorphologist from the National Marine Fisheries Service, talk about salmon recovery and barriers. And I guess there's two take-home messages that tie into, I think, the things that Steve has been working on and the new water policy and what we've been doing. Perhaps very interesting in terms of the goals of restoring wetlands in the bay and the delta is that salmon spend a substantial amount of their time out of the main or single-thread channels, and that's essential for them developing the size necessary to be able to survive in the ocean. Obviously true in coastal lagoons and the like. We don't really know what to do about that, but the idea of preserving and restoring wetlands is at least a piece of it. The thing that I found most striking, and I think ties into the need to discuss the new policy objectives of the legislature, is that he provided some very compelling information that pumping for frost control in the winery business, as the vineyards have moved down to the valley floor, has been dewatering streams like the Russian and its tributaries by as much as 50%, leaving salmon fry high and dry. This is, of course, an endangered species, and, of course, flow criteria are to be established not merely for the Delta, but for all of California streams. So what we do with this new policy, what it means, how it might be manifest itself in our encouragement of low-impact developments, I think are all kind of new areas where the science and the policy is telling us that we got to rethink some of our conventional thinking. So that's all I have to report, but I find it very interesting.
Great. Board Member Peacock?
I think so.
Shalom looks good today, too. He's walking without a cane today, right? You'll be ready for the mountains again soon.
And he heals like a 50-year-old. It's not fair.
Vice Chair, please.
Yes, sir. I had a number of interesting meetings this month. It was fun to be a board member this past month. I met with Judy Kelly, and we talked about the our trash baseline and the potential for making sure that our implementation program and setting up the trash baseline goes well, and also the implementation of the $5 million grant for trash capture devices. The implementation of that is
everybody's benefit. Who Judy Kelly is?
Oh, I'm sorry. She's with the San Francisco Estuary Project, and we
now partnership.
Partnership. Sorry, I'm showing my age. As the ABAG member of this board, I'm reminded every time I go to an ABAG meeting of how much the SFEP is doing that really benefits the kinds of water quality programs that we are promoting. So I'm very grateful that she is out there, and particularly with the implementation of getting the money out for the trash capture devices and figuring out how to spread it around the region. It's wonderful that she and her staff are doing that work. I also met with Mike Connor of the East Bay Dischargers Authority. We talked about emerging contaminants and some of the interesting, they would be funny if they weren't so difficult, you know, problems that occur in the treatment plants because of the wonderful consumer chemicals that we are all using. Apparently the things that we use to make our hair shiny are blowing up the fuel cells and that sort of thing. It's a very large challenge because, as we all know, there's no feedback mechanism for getting information like that back into the consumer marketplace at the moment in this country. But some of these chemicals are causing very serious practical problems at the treatment plants, and as we know, we know little about what happens to many of them when they go through the treatment plants and enter the bay and the other waters. We also talked at some length about strategic planning and how we at the board might work with the dischargers to better use existing data to provide information that would enable us to target our efforts to protect and improve water quality and just, you know, make our money go a little further and faster by targeting our efforts. And we brainstormed some potential pilot programs, and we'll just see where any of that goes. I'm on number 3 out of 4, so bear with me. I also met with Daryl Dietz with the Center for International Environmental Law in Washington, D.C., to talk about the California's Green Chemistry Program. He was one of the folks who helped sort of set it up and put it together. And it was very interesting for me to hear that background, since I'm going to be following that issue up on behalf of this regional board until you fire me. It was also very interesting to hear how the California program is going to benefit from what is happening in Europe with their REACH program. It's a program that they have to go back and look at a certain number of chemicals each year and determine whether there should be limitations on how much of those chemicals are marketed and the purposes for which they're marketed. The two ways that directly influences California is that it provides information, public information, that has heretofore not been available on the both the ecological and the human health effects of various chemicals that are used in the products that we encounter every day. But also, if there are limits on how chemicals can be used in products in Europe, since it is the largest consumer group in the world, big companies that are marketing their products to Europe are probably going to market the same things to us. So we will indirectly benefit from, I think it's a benefit, we'll indirectly be affected by their regulatory efforts. Okay, last and certainly not least, I was able to spend a morning with Tam Doduk, which was very, very fruitful for me. And I know Tam just made a joke about, you know, there's never any good news from Sacramento, but my experience is that there are a lot of good people in Sacramento trying to make good news happen. So I was very appreciative that she would spend that time with me to discuss some of the ins and outs of how we can use our resources here at the board more strategically and how our efforts fit in with those of other boards and regional boards and the state board. So, a fun month. Thank you.
Thank you for your commitment, Vice Chair. You really, and your information, there's a lot of information that is out there to share, and I thank you for that. And I guess if we were in San Francisco or Sacramento, staff could tweet her or email her or whatever the heck you want to do with your device there, so you don't have to interrupt her. But we don't do that here. We just say it as it is. So now we'll go on to Executive Officer Bruce.
A few things with all seem to have the economic theme to them. There was the mention, Mr. Chair, you made on the brownfield item, and I think it is both indicative of the sign of the times that we are having fewer applications for brownfield oversight, but at the same time, as included in the package, the lessons learned are that the efforts made to do brownfield cleanup pay significant dividends. It's demonstrating that it is worthwhile to do environmental cleanup because it has very significant long-term benefits, as definitely exemplified by the example given in the package about the Great Mall down the old Ford Motor Plant down in Milpitas, which is a true success story. Along that lines, the past month has been very heavy in recognizing the anniversary of the federal stimulus package, and as Chair noted, the event we had a few weeks ago in El Cerrito to recognize both the water quality projects that have been funded and specifically the Green Streets project that is in El Cerrito. And this is having a lot of dividends, both from the perspective that the state of California has been very good about committing its federal stimulus funds and is getting some additional funds from those states that didn't use all of theirs. And an example being that now there is some additional funding coming to Caltrans, and we're working with EPA's assistance to try to marry projects such as the Green Streets that were done in El Cerrito with the fact that San Pablo Avenue is actually a state highway. And so it would be appropriate for Caltrans to be able to use some of its new federal stimulus funding to expand the Green Streets up and down San Pablo Avenue and potentially at other urban highways where you have some of these opportunities to do low-impact development or retrofit there on the federal dollar. So that's something we're going to push, and hopefully I'll soon have some success stories on that. Another economic tie that's not expressly in the executive officer's report, but Board Member McGrath asked me to bring it up. One of the big economic engines in the Bay Area are ports and the associated need to dredge our ports to keep shipping going. And it's not only dredging in ports, but also dredging in navigation channels, especially leading up to Sacramento and Stockton, dredging in smaller marinas, and even protective dredging over things like the BART tunnel through the bay. And the challenge over the many years has been, when you dredge, what to do with dredge material. Where should it go? Historically, most of it went to a deep hole near Alcatraz. That deep hole over time was not so deep. And there were also strong concerns over the local fishing community over the potential impacts of in-bay disposal. So a lot of that begot the long-term management strategy for dredge material, LTMS as we call it, and the goal of that, established approximately 10 years ago, was that rather than so much material disposed in bay, that the goal would be 40% of the rich material be used on upland projects for beneficial reuse, 40% in the ocean, ideally again for beneficial aspects, and only 20% in the bay. And on the back of the Port of Oakland's 50-foot deepening project, we've by and large met that, but the 50-foot deepening project doesn't go on indefinitely. So it's a challenge to identify both the projects and the funding that can be used to take that material upland. The prime area that's received upland material, and this will even be touched on later in the Department of Defense status report, is the Hamilton Wetland Restoration Project at the old Hamilton Airfield. And that's by and large been a very strong success to date. We have nearly 6 million cubic yards of dredge material has gone to Hamilton. The challenge now is that the Army Corps has been providing funding for a significant portion of that, but has a state cost share that's being provided by the State Coastal Conservancy on that. And the cost of the project is going up. The federal cost share appears to have been increased from Washington. And so right now there are some machinations going on between the Corps and the Coastal Conservancy on continued funding both Hamilton and the adjacent project that would be, over time, also returned to wetlands at Belmar and Keys, just north of Hamilton. So that is something that I'm tracking. I serve on the management committee of the long-term management strategy group, along with Will Travis of BCDC, Alexis Strauss of EPA, and whoever the current Army Corps colonel is, and the four of us do meet with staff about every 2 months to go over dredging issues, and also meet with the public at the same time. And so this is something that's a very significant issue, is how can we both look at the big picture, is this goal of 2040 still realistic, and how can we keep dredging projects moving when there is the funding challenge, that we ideally want to take as much material upland as we can, but there's not always the funding to be able to do that. So I'll keep you posted as this plays out. I know it's something that Board Member McGrath has joined at the hip with for the last 15, 20 years, but it is a very significant program, and it probably doesn't get as much attention as it should, but we are reminded at every LTMS meeting by the community that dredging drives the economic engine of this region. So it's something we need to focus on.
So, through the chair, if I could, Bruce. So it does look like we've gotten a fair amount of material into Hamilton, and the fiscal problem at the moment seems to be the increase in the cost share from 25% to 35%. And if the Coastal Conservancy can't use Belmarine Keys as part of that, then they've got a cash flow problem. Is that
right? That's in a nutshell what the issue is, but also looking at, is the cost to complete Hamilton increasing, or can we, with a limited increase in dredge material, say we've raised the level of the old airfield enough so that we can...
And how are we on the federal side? The project was authorized at a certain level. Is there still money?
That money still exists through WERDA, the Water Resources Development Act. So that money is there, but the Corps says it needs to have that state match to be able to access it. So that's where the Coastal Conservancy and the Corps are doing a little bit of back and forth, including looking at, are there things that can be done to decrease the cost of the Hamilton project so that the associated match can be decreased.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
And that's it for this month.
Very good. Thank you. If not, we'll move on further item 5, the consideration of uncontested items. And
we probably should do our swearing in.
Oh, I apologize. Too many papers here. Okay, here we go. need a little light here, as Vice Chair said, our eyes. All relevant evidence which any person desires to be considered by this board first be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, and secondly by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and staff counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, address, and whom he or she represents. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony which is reasonably relevant to the issue. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Thank you. And thanks for getting the volume up, too. I think it's a little more comfortable for everybody in the back. So at this time, on the consideration of uncontested items, I have a card with Ian regarding 5A, and I believe we have some comments on 5B also, correct? If anyone, can we, how do you want to do this?
Well, we...
5A card, I
We do not have any supplemental or other material.
No. So we can just pull 5A for the moment.
So if we want to hear comments on 5A, we should pull that and then consider the
Okay.
Others.
So what we'll do is we'll pull 5A and we could vote on the others first, and we'll go ahead and vote on the others unless someone has a brief comment they would like to make on any of the other items. These are some pretty major agenda items here, and I don't want to take them too lightly, but staff and everyone's worked very, very, very hard on this. So, yes, and so I'd like the Vice Chair to make a quick comment if she would like, or comment, whatever she would like.
Yeah, I just had a question and a clarification. But before I start, I did want to thank staff for providing a very clear rationale for the reasons why we're providing the dilution credits that we're providing for selenium. I did have some comments on that previously on the Valero Venetia refinery, and I appreciate the way you handled it in this step. So for my question, I noticed that in section 3 on page 3 of the appendix A, we ask the dischargers to implement effluent and receiving water selenium characterization studies.
And this is on 5B?
Yes, I'm sorry. And we provide a lot of information both in that section and in the table about the procedures that we want to have followed, but we don't actually state very clearly what the objectives of the characterization studies are. I did find that we filled that gap and discussed the objectives for the study on attachment F in the fact sheet on page F6, and I was just wondering whether procedurally that's going to be any cause for confusion or whether we're certain that everyone's on the same page about why we're doing these studies and what objectives they have to fulfill.
Well, and the fact sheet is expressly part of the permit, so it does travel with the permit, and the fact sheet, in fact, is intended to give the background why we have the various requirements in all parts of the amendment. And I think your point is well taken in that those table 4, the task list, and the basis for the study on page F6 should be considered together. We do expect, as part of task 1 and table 4, that we would receive a study plan and then we would have time to review it. And you will note that in the task list, task 2, implementation, beginning implementation of the study plan, is not scheduled for till about 75 days after the receipt of the study plan, which will provide us some opportunity to review that, and if we have any need to revisit with the dischargers, we can. But it's our goal that this is very much the task list on table four, but the background is given on infection.
All right. Well, thank you. Now we know everyone's on the same page.
What pages?
Thank you for that clarification. Any other comments, Steve? Okay.
No, so you said it very well, Chair. There's a lot of work here.
Yeah, and I appreciate everyone involved participating today. And so if I may ask you, if we vote here soon, that you just hang on for a minute till we get through 5A. So what I think we'll do is we'll vote on the uncontested except for 5A and then hear 5A. So with that, I would accept a motion on the uncontested items with the exception of 5A.
So moved.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliyahu?
Aye.
Mr. McGrath?
Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye.
Mr. Peacock?
Aye.
Mr. Schroeder?
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Aye.
Mr. Mahler?
Aye. So ordered, and if I may ask everyone to kind of hold with us, then we'll have 5A. Ian, you had a comment, please, or a question? Where are you? There you are. I believe it's you.
Yes, we did not plan a presentation on this, so we jump into comments.
With Baykeepers.
Good morning, Board. My name is Ian Rand. I'm staff scientist with Baykeeper. Unfortunately, we didn't submit written comments this order, but we'd like to take the opportunity to comment on this tentative order, which could result in significant increases to cyanide copper loads to the bay. This order introduces much less stringent water quality-based effluent limits compared to the interim limits contained in the discharger's NPDES permits on the grounds that the existing limits are based on faulty assumptions. However, no justification is provided for throwing out the original limits, nor is it explained why the previous assumptions were faulty. For instance, under this TO, cyanide MDELs for the ConocoPhillips facility would increase by 68%, and the proposed limit represents a 6.5-fold increase in MDEL limits compared to what the regional board originally proposed in 2005, but was deemed infeasible by the discharger. In response, the 2005 NPDES permit weakened the original proposed standards without scientific, statistical, or technical justification, and this order would further increase the effluent limit to a significant degree for all listed dischargers. There's no indication that dischargers would find difficulty in meeting much lower effluent limitations. For example, cyanide concentrations at ConocoPhillips are in the range of 3 to 9 micrograms per liter, yet under this order that their limit would appear increased to 42 micrograms per liter. The tentative order states that the interim limits are based on flawed assumptions, but does it not describe what these assumptions are and what way they are flawed. In regards to copper, the proposed MDEL for Conoco is 324% higher than the existing limit and 500% higher than the originally proposed limits in 2005, which ConocoPhillips did deem infeasible. There are no reason to increase the limit to 120 micrograms per liter when existing data states that the 99th percentile of recent copper effluent data is 45 micrograms per liter. Similarly, the copper MDEL for Napa Sanitation District has been unnecessarily increased from 21.5 micrograms per liter to 120 micrograms per liter, even though the discharger demonstrated that the lower interim standard was entirely feasible. This tentative order would grant dischargers significant leeway in increasing loads of cyanide and copper, and we respectfully request that this tentative order be denied at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Staff, do you have a quick response? I know this is kind of unusual here, or I think from my perspective of what I have read, I'm very comfortable with what staff is recommending at this time, and so I don't want to get into a dialogue with them, with the speaker, but if you could kind of just clear up some very... it's all right, we do this, legal counsel? Yeah, just clear up some of the concerns there.
MPD. It's very loud with MPDS division. I don't know the specifics of each discharge and how we're changing the limit and all that, but I can address his question about the faulty assumptions. Some of the previous limits were established in those permits based on some assumptions in the early rounds of the site-specific objectives that staff used, and through that process, those were changed. So we didn't feel like, we think it would be incorrect to stay with those earlier assumptions and arrive at a limit that's based on site-specific objectives that you did not adopt. So those were the assumptions that we're talking about. In terms of, allowing increases in loads of discharge, we don't think that will happen because there are copper and cyanide action plans in this order as part of these what may be perceived as relaxed limits. And we think those steps are more effective in controlling the amount of copper and cyanide going into the bay. And there are triggers that was part of the site-specific objectives that you adopted, that if the bay, reached these trigger levels, then we would go back to each one of these dischargers and require additional action. We think that that's a much more effective way to control this than holding to some number that is not equitably, in a way, allocated to all the dischargers. Just because of the luck of the draw of how their previous permit limit was established. So that's generally my response.
Thank you. Any comments from board members?
Yeah, and I think you touched on something I'm interested in, Lila, about the inequitable distribution of our requirements, based on a point in time. And so to use, I think the commenter has looked at the issue narrowly, comparing, what was there before to what's proposed now. And there is a context of which is mentioned in the item about the basin plan amendment process. And it has, the revised, updated scientific information to base the effluent limits on, as well as a plan of action to assure that we don't degrade water quality and the anti-degradation provisions. So, I'm supporting staff recommendation wholeheartedly, knowing about the details of the derivation of the site-specific water quality objectives. And I recommend to my fellow board members that we're on sound footing. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other comments? Otherwise, we'll take staff's recommendation.
Right. I haven't heard anything that would give us pause to change wording in this, so I'd recommend adoption of the tentative order that you have before you for 5A.
Would entertain a motion, please?
Move adoption.
Second.
That's on 5A. And any further discussion? If not, roll call vote, please. Barron?
Mr. Allen?
Aye.
Mr. McGrath?
Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye.
Mr. Pickoff?
Aye.
Mr. Schroeder?
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Aye.
Hi, thank you. And again, thank all of you who have been involved in this. These agenda items. It's a very lengthy process, and I think everyone and staff have done a fine job. So
and stakeholders too.
Yep, without a doubt, the stakeholders. So I guess you could all slip out of the room here cautiously, quietly, and leave poor East Bay to fight for themselves here. Don't forget, they'll have their turn in front of us again someday.
So item 6 is consideration of the reissuance of the NPDES permit for the East Bay Municipal Utility District's main wastewater treatment plant. Mike Roberts would give the staff presentation on this item.
Okay.
Good morning, Chairman Mueller and members of the board. My name is Robert Schliff. I'm an engineer in the NPDES Wastewater Control Division. This tentative order would reissue the NPDES permit for East Bay Mud's main wastewater treatment plant. This map is the same one you saw when you adopted the permit for East Bay Mud's wet weather facilities in January 2009 and for the permits for the East Bay collection systems in November 2009. It shows the area of each of the East Bay community's seven collection systems, the location of East Bay Mud's three wet weather facilities. You can see Point Isabel, San Antonio Creek, and Oakport, and the location of East Bay Mud's main wastewater treatment plant.
Yeah.
The communities or satellites collect and transport their wastewater to East Bay Mud's treatment facilities. They include Steach Sanitary District and the cities of Albany, Berkeley, Emeryville, Piedmont, Oakland, and Alameda. And more than 99% of the wastewater generated from these communities, about 65 million gallons per day, is treated at East Bay Mud's main wastewater treatment plant, which is the third largest treatment plant in our region, and it's discharged via a deep water diffuser that it's about a mile from the Bay shoreline near the Bay Bridge. And today it's this specific discharge for which you are considering requirements. So before going into the requirements of the tentative order and East Bay Mud's treatment process, I wanted to give you some more background on East Bay Mud's service area. As you know from previous board hearings, during wet weather, great amounts of inflow and infiltration enter through leaks and sewer pipes, and this water flows to East Bay Mud's treatment facilities. And how East Bay Mud should handle these wet weather flows is one of the main issues with this permit reissuance. So some facts to consider. East Bay Mud serves about 650,000 people, and it owns and operates 40 miles of large sewer pipe. The satellites are responsible for about 1,700 miles of sewer pipe, and private property owners are responsible for about 1,500 miles. So to reduce wet weather flows, it's really important that East Bay Mud work closely with both the satellites and private property owners to reduce the number of leaky sewer pipes. So this slide shows the treatment process. And first, what I'd like to do is to describe the normal process and then what happens during high wet weather conditions. So wastewater is first treated by a series of screens and grit chambers and primary clarifiers, and it's in these units where most of the solids are removed. And from primary clarifiers, wastewater flows to secondary treatment units. And this is where microbes provide biological treatment to break down the waste, and secondary clarifiers settle out the microbes. Treated wastewater is then disinfected and discharged to the bed. Now, in wet weather, East Bay Mud does not have enough secondary treatment capacity to process high influent flows. So to protect microbes and secondary treatment from being flushed out, East Bay Mud does two things. First, it uses an 11 million gallon storage pond. So when influent flows threaten to exceed the capacity of secondary treatment, East Bay Mud will divert a portion of its flow prior to primary treatment to the storage pond. So that's what you see right here with this dotted green arrow labeled wet weather diversion. Influent flows, they're too high. East Bay Mud won't be able to process them through secondary treatment. So this water goes to a storage pond, and then it's eventually returned back to the headworks of the treatment plant. And this is an effective way to level out flows to secondary treatment for short duration storms. However, during larger storms, about 10 to 20 times a year, the storage pond, it doesn't have enough capacity to handle these high wet weather flows. So East Bay Mud must divert around secondary treatment. And that's what you see right here with this dotted green arrow labeled wet weather bypass. And these flows that go around secondary treatment, they still receive solids removal here in the primary treatment system. They get disinfected, and they get recombined with secondary treated wastewater that's also disinfected, and then discharged to the bed. And this type of wet weather bypass is what we call blending. And it's important to note that all effluent limits must be met during blending events. So now that we've gone over some background information, I wanted to shift gears and talk about comments. We received comment letters on this item from San Francisco Baykeeper and Our Children's Earth, East Bay Mud, and the East Bay Satellites. East Bay Mud and the East Bay Satellites are generally supportive of the tentative order. The main objections to this item are from San Francisco Baykeeper and Our Children's Earth. And of their comments, the most significant one concerns blending. Baykeeper and Our Children's Earth state that the tentative order illegally authorizes bypass or blending because it is prohibited unless necessary for essential maintenance or to prevent substantial property damage. We disagree. The tentative order's allowance for blending is consistent with federal regulations, which provide that bypasses are allowed if three conditions are met. First, the bypass was unavoidable to prevent severe property damage. Second, there are no feasible alternatives to bypass. And third, the discharger submitted notices. And East Bay Mud meets all three of these conditions. Nonetheless, the tentative order would still require East Bay Mud to complete a number of tasks to reduce blending. These tasks include optimizing the use of the on-site storage pond and ensuring that process operations maximize flows through secondary treatment. Finally, East Bay Mud is currently under a court order to implement measures that will reduce the quantity of inflow and infiltration during wet weather. And this court order was in part an outcome of the January 2009 permit he adopted for East Bay Mud's wet weather facilities. And one measure that East Bay Mud has already completed is the adoption of a regional private sewer lateral ordinance. And this ordinance is going to require the replacement of defective laterals prior to changes in property ownership. Finally, the other main concern from Baykeeper and Archibald Conserve is that they believe that the tentative order should require more extensive monitoring during blending events. And we disagree. The level of monitoring proposed in the tentative order is adequate and it's appropriate in consideration of past data and practical constraints. We looked at data from blending events over the last 5 years, and it showed that East Bay Mud would meet all their effluent limits during blending. The tentative order would require East Bay Mud to monitor blending using total suspended solids as an indicator for compliance. So if total suspended solids is high, then East Bay Mud would be required to monitor for nearly every other limited toxic pollutant. Additionally, at least once a year, East Bay Mud is required to monitor for those toxic pollutants regardless of suspended solids levels. And this level of monitoring is consistent with what the board adopted at last month's board hearing, and it's appropriate for blending events, considering their short-term nature and the practical constraints due to the unpredictable timing of storms. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from board members? We'll start right down here. Board member Frodo.
I've always been aware that rainwater gets into sewer systems and they all have holding ponds and so on. How does it get in the system to such a high degree? Is it leaky pipes, is that what you're saying, or is it manhole covers? Or
It's a combination of things. There can be inflow, which goes through leaky manhole covers. A lot of it's leaky pipes in the East Bay, because when the sewer pipes were constructed, a lot of it was done in the 40s and 50s, so maybe half of it's clay pipe, which is old and leaky.
Okay, so it's...
So in this case, a lot of it's probably infiltration into leaky pipes.
Okay. And I guess it's also useful to recognize that we're trying to emphasize those sources and ways to minimize that flow, but the two big sources are the collection lines that the cities and sanitary districts own, and the need to constantly maintain and keep things like tree roots and such out, but also the private laterals that each of us as homeowners own, that portion of the line that goes from the house into the city's line. And that's been the ongoing challenge, because historically there's been a little awareness by the public that they even have a sewer lateral that they're responsible for, but it's rarely inspected, and that's where these lateral ordinances are starting to come into play. It's been somewhat controversial because the real estate community doesn't want another item to potentially slow down the transfer of properties, and it's also, if we only do it at transfer of properties, it's sort of a slow boat. So this work that will be done with East Bay communities is potentially going to be a model for how we can better address this, not only region-wide, but statewide, of trying to see how we can level the playing field.
I can see that as a long-term solution. And what about, is there any thought of a long-term solution of, and I know it's probably very costly, but to increase storage capacity in these ponds?
That's been looked into. The cost of doing that is pretty astronomical given the amount of inflow that's coming in right now. So the current process is really to go after inflow and infiltration into the collection system and see where that gets you, and then maybe storage is an option down the road, because you want to design to how much storage you actually need.
Right. Okay, thank you.
And some of that work has been done in the past. These three wet weather facilities were actually designed and built in the 80s based on a number of studies of how much storage you should do versus overflow. And the interceptor lines that East Bay Mud owns, that Robert pointed out in that map, those are all designed very large so that there's actually significant capacity in those lines. So the flow itself, when it rains, the flow doesn't immediately get to the plant. It has some detention time in there, but obviously that's limited.
Yeah, and just quickly, if I may, in fairness to Board Member Schroeder, this is kind of new to him, and so this is something we've all kind of lived with a little bit, the Sinai world, and it might be good sometime in a presentation that you actually, I find that the more I can visually show broken pipes, underground, private laterals, it does make the process a little easier to get through for people to understand, and it's just a matter of ground shifting. It seems like everything underground no one's looking at because it's not there, but we're dealing with it in our community right now when we talked about raising sewer rates because everyone's like, well, why would you raise our sewer rate? Well, because we've got broken pipes out there. So these are tough things we all have to deal with on the INI. And storage, just quickly, I think wastewater businesses have made some very successful companies out there with their storage tank rentals over the years. Put it gently, our dear friends at Rain for Rent, been a very successful company by renting us all tanks for the winter time. So anyway, we'll go back to Board Member Moore.
Yeah, if you need some sewer videos, I can provide them for you.
Well, when Dr. Singh's going to be back, I would imagine he's going to have some we don't want to see.
Anyway, I'll keep my comments brief, Robert, but I want to point out the good work that you did here. And it relates to a couple of things that we talked about today and last month even, in terms of a question about blending events and monitoring and what is the value of monitoring and what kind of data. The new standard provisions focus on indicators of problems and meeting effluent limits, specifically solids. And there's a lot of technical basis for that, what we talked about last month. And there was we actually asked you to look maybe a little bit at the data that we collected during blending events. And that has been reflected in your response to comments on page 6. It's a quick overview. It has some indicators there. I just want to recognize that. And this relates to Dr. Young's conversation with Mike Connor, which is we have a lot of data we collect, and I think it's a great use to help make these decisions and to answer questions, good questions by the stakeholders. You know, should we be monitoring more closely? So I appreciate the effort. It wasn't a great deal of effort, but it got to the point. It uses the information we have in-house to make a decision on something that will affect, outlay of capital costs for monitoring, during these events, and logistical challenges to accomplish all of that monitoring, following all the analytical methods and sampling methodologies. And a good answer about, how about the toxicity of this? Well, let's look at the duration, and these kind of good technical discussions. So I just wanted to commend you on following through on what the board asked you to do last month, but also, bringing information in-house to the table to have a good technical discussion. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any other questions of staff? We do have a card on this. If not, we can get back to staff, or would you rather wait?
I can do it.
Okay, very good, Vice Chair. So at this time, Jason, come forward, please. Blenders with Baykeepers. I do not have any cards from East Bay. Would you like to put some in?
Good morning, board members. My name is Jason Flanders, staff attorney at San Francisco Baykeeper. I want to thank Robert for his very good presentation and very detailed response to our comments. I appreciate that. I do want to focus on the issue of blending. First of all, as a general matter, blending is a prohibited bypass under the Clean Water Act, and the EPA's guidance policy says that EPA, quote, strongly discourages blending as a long-term wet weather management approach. And we think this permit actually
veers from the regional board's approach to undertreated discharges that you've taken recently with regard to the wet weather facility, with regard to the satellite permits. Because really, if you look at the minimization requirements in this permit for blending events, it represents a status quo. And it asks to maximize use of an existing storage pond, to maximize existing secondary treatment, and to comply with the stipulated order. Well, all those things are currently existing requirements. In contrast, the EPA's guideline regulations say to evaluate feasible means to minimize blending events going forward. Instead of requiring that analysis from the permittee now, the permit relies on the 2007 study, which is a little dated because it predates a lot of the work that this board and others have done with regard to the wet weather facilities and the satellite facilities, and we think that information should be taken into account when deciding what feasible measures there are available to minimize the frequency of blending. Also, the 2000 study, it really takes an all-or-nothing approach with regard to, say, storage. Yeah, the costs are astronomical, but we think some, as Robert indicated, storage could be part of the solution, and so some partial use of storage at a lesser cost in conjunction with more funding of lateral replacements in satellite communities and other ongoing work with satellites would reduce the frequency of blending events. The permit only requires that the permittee do a new feasibility analysis within 180 days of the permit expiring, and makes the point that that minimization measures should not begin now because they would take longer to complete than the life of the permit. We're afraid if that logic prevails, then it will prevail again when the permit is reissued. And precisely because they're going to take so long, we think a new feasibility analysis, a current feasibility analysis, needs to occur now as the permit is up for renewal. The only other thing I wanted to comment on was the list of discharge prohibitions in the permits. We think when listing the prohibited discharges, that all prohibited discharges should be listed. Right now, the permit does not prohibit discharges to waters of the state or to streets, public places, and we just think as a matter of good public policy, there should be a document, and this permit is the appropriate document to list all prohibited discharges from the system. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Would you like to comment now, Vice Chair? Or did you have a card? Okay, it's coming. Come forward, please.
Good morning. Chair Muller, board members, my name is Ben Hornstein.
Yeah, Ben, I did not have a card for you. Okay. Sorry about that. Now we do. Go.
I'm the manager of environmental services of the East Bay Municipal Utility District. I wanted to first thank staff for their hard work, their good work getting these permits out, which is among, of course, the many challenging issues on their plate in their work to protect San Francisco Bay. East Bay Mud, in working with this particular permit, found that the recent efforts over the last few years by staff in striving to make these permits clearer and more consistent has been quite successful. It's much easier to understand these permits and work with these new permits, and we appreciate it. There is an issue we wanted to call to your attention, blending, which everyone else has as well, so we don't need to call it to your attention, but touch on very briefly, and we won't get into the big debate on blending, which is a national debate, and it's quite passionate and complicated and has a number of aspects and very significant consequences where it ultimately rests, and we aren't sure where that will be. As to this particular permit, East Bay Mud is hopeful but not completely confident that we can comply with the new requirements under blending in this permit. We do understand that staff is trying to respond to this ever-evolving EPA approach on this matter of blending, as well as a range of stakeholder perspectives. And I suppose I would just only urge the board to, as this national debate unfolds, to be deliberate in your actions as you are, and not necessarily get too far ahead of this national debate in the rest of the country, as we're all trying to meet the challenge of prioritizing resources, and we're hopeful that will be part of the debate as well. I did want to just touch very briefly on the comment, the good comment by Baykeeper on the notion of status quo, and I would say, as you know, we received a stipulated order this past July from you and EPA in regards to our wet weather facilities, but all of the work and the very significant resources and efforts going into meeting the mandate of that federal order will in fact reduce blending. So that includes the private sewer lateral ordinance that our board passed last month and will be going into effect in the fall. It includes a couple million dollars a year in flow meters that we're putting throughout our system, ultimately leading to the potential for flow limits coming in from our satellite communities, as well as spending $2 million a year. We're developing a program to incentivize folks to repair and replace their private sewer laterals beyond what the ordinance requires. And we're also developing an asset management program for our interceptors and for the satellite systems. And all of that is required under your order. And all those things will not only decrease the discharge out of our wet weather facilities, but they will also decrease the volume, the frequency, and the duration of blending events at our main wastewater treatment plant. That was all I had.
Thank you. And for the record, I must apologize, Ben. You could let the general manager know you had a card in. So, Miss Job Market, I want to make sure you get recognition for that. You didn't miss the card, so thank you for that. Comments, Vice Chair? Right, I think you can stand down. Any comments for the speaker? Okay, so we'll go back to staff, please. And we can start, let's start down there. Okay, Board Member McGrath?
I think I always appreciate and read very carefully the comments of the Baykeeper. I think they're not merely valuable to the process. I think they're essential to the process. And I'm always careful when I take a different tack to explain that, so I'm going to do that now. I think, as alluded briefly to by East Bay Mud, this is a matter of establishing clear priorities. First and most important, as the staff pointed out, and as I checked with the executive officer yesterday, all effluent limits must be met under this permit. There's good news and bad news with the higher volume of water that's associated with wet weather. It's good in the sense that what waste is diluted, but it's bad in the sense that the volume and the dilute levels are really problematic for the activated sludge treatment, which is the technology here. Now, the good thing about activated sludge technology is it's overall, in dry weather, the best way of getting contaminants, including some of the organics that we don't even completely understand, out of the waste flow. And you don't want to overwhelm it with fresh water. And you particularly don't want to overwhelm it with dilute waste because there really isn't enough food in there for the organisms to operate at their optimum level. So as I look at that, the idea of the conceptual way to approach that is not to store more in a pond because you've got dilute waste. It's not good for the system, but it's to get the volumes down. I will agree with you that dilution of the waste load, even if it meets the statutory requirements, is not optimal. But where our priorities are, I think, and should be, is reducing the inflow and the infiltration. That's what we've done. It wasn't entirely popular when we did it. The local governments were all kind of worried about that fiscally. But in terms of where the fiscal resources should go, it should be there, not into monitoring, not into storage, but to get the volumes down. So you've raised good points. The last point that I want to comment on is you did ask about more flow. I went back and checked the volume. The flow in this system is 62 million gallons. The capacity is about 168. They start to blend at about 150, so they don't overwhelm it. They've got plenty of capacity. Capacity is a very expensive thing to add in terms of our priorities of getting this waste reduced. So I'm going to support the staff recommendation for those reasons. I think the analysis of data, but most important, it's a matter of how we set priorities to deal with this problem.
Thank you. Vice Chair?
Yes. I'd like to echo Jim's comments, actually. First of all, with respect to Baykeeper's comments, I also appreciate them very much, but just like Jim, in this case, I am happy that we are putting our resources towards source reduction, reducing inflow and infiltration in the satellite areas so that we can get rid of the problem instead of putting our money towards treating it. You know, it's a judgment call, but I think we're doing the right thing on that one. I'm supportive of this permit, but I do want to drill down on another issue that Baykeeper raised, which I think is a very, very important one, and that is the current distinction between waters of the United States and waters of the state. And I'm talking to our lawyers now because this is a lawyer issue. As most of you know, the Rapanos decision in the Supreme Court substantially narrowed the definition of waters of the United States so that they no longer apparently encompass many wetlands that are not contiguous with navigable waters, meaning things that you can actually put big boats in. Similarly, ephemeral streams seem to be cut out of the definition. There are many areas, I think, in this region that are now waters of the state that are not either not waters of the United States or that someone might argue are not waters of the United States. Many of you may have seen the very long article in the New York Times, Sunday New York Times, about a week and a half ago, talking about states where large dischargers are discharging into small streams that are not waters of the United States. They discharge into the small streams. The small streams run into the navigable waters, which are waters of the United States, but they have the states that in which they live have no permit authority, so they're just discharging. I read that and I thought, well, so glad I live in California where we have the Porter-Cologne Act and we don't have to deal with that. But, you know, we're going to have to start being clear in our permits about the fact that the discharges that we are regulating, if they go into the waters of the United States, we can regulate them under either the Clean Water Act or the Porter-Cologne Act, but if they're in the waters of the state that are not waters of the United States, I want us to be legally clear that our permits cover those instances. And I thank Baykeeper for bringing up that issue in this permit. I think it goes way beyond this permit, and it's something that we need to get a clear guidance on from our attorneys and from the state board on when we're issuing an NPDES permit, when we also have to cite Porter-Cologne and waters of the state. I know there's an issue because waters of the state then include groundwater, and for a permit like this one, including groundwater, just vastly expands the universe of things that people have to put their limited money and limited time towards, and that's an issue. So, you know, but at the same time, we don't want to stop regulating surface waters of the state that don't happen to be waters of the U.S. So I wanted to flag that issue. I really don't think it's a problem for this permit. I don't think East Bay Mud is looking for loopholes, so I don't think it's going to be an issue. But we need to get that straight.
Thank you. Any other comments? Yes,
Board Member Moore. I'll try to keep it brief. I think Board Member McGrath covered a lot of my opinions on this matter, and I certainly respect and appreciate the emphasis to bring this matter to a discussion level that it's at. It's very elevated now. But I then am going to take a little bit of a counterpoint in my comments that, you know, what I see here is a bit of a, it's kind of a decision point, or I think we're kind of coming to a head regionally on the discussion on blending a bit. And I really want to put my support firmly behind staff's approach on this. That, you know, if you reach a certain point, you know, what I see with the Baykeeper and our Children's Earth comments is a lack of engineering judgment a bit. You know, it's a little more tilted toward the legal. And if you look at all kinds of the engineering decisions we make in our infrastructure, whether it's traffic, you know, parking or whatever, you design for a certain level, you know, the 20-year shopping event or whatever, you know, as Keith Lichten has brought up. You know, in this regard, there are real sustainability of the infrastructure issue. You know, the issue of sustainability of the infrastructure comes up when natural processes, i.e. rainfall and runoff, exceed a certain design level. And the costs really go up exponentially to meet a strict legal goal of not blending. And, you know, I, in a flippant way, say, well, you feel like this is the war on blending. You know, we're going to end blending. And then I hearken back to, what does the monitoring information tell us? It's, you know, what are we fighting here? What is the water quality threat of it, really? And I think staff, in an indirect way, in the discussion of that, has kind of, I think, put a beachhead down in the discussion in this item. You know, and I appreciate East Bay Mud's comments about, you know, let's look at the national debate. I mean, I can provide a little perspective on that. When we attended the, my company representatives attended the national conference, you know, the WEFTEC conference, where the sewer engineers and folks get together once a year. And, you know, we're hearing stories about and presentations about new treatment plants where blending is a feature that is proudly discussed. You know, it, today, you know, 2009, this is being talked about in Chicago. And so, you know, the engineers come back to the Bay Area and think, why are we getting kind of a different treatment on this matter? And you know, is it because, well, we're going to protect water quality, you know, more than anybody else in the nation, but are we really protecting water quality by prohibiting blending strictly? Now, I think it's really important from an infrastructure management perspective to minimize blending. There's other reasons to keep an eye on the collection system. So I don't want to undermine that or the, you know, the importance of how Baykeeper and others have elevated that discussion and how we have a statewide order for prohibiting sanitary sewer overflows. It's come out of that discussion that I think has moved the issue forward in the public's perception of the importance of wastewater infrastructure. So I think there's a lot of value in this. But at a certain point, we have to recognize the practical engineering limitations. And I think staff has done that. So I support the staff recommendation. Thanks.
Thank you. And if I could just put, we talked about data and that evil word of flow monitoring with member agencies. So these are very, very sensitive areas because when we put those flow meters in, everybody wants them at their neighbor's downstream and not theirs. So it's a tough world to deal with when you're dealing with member agencies because no one wants to take the blame. So I compliment them on that work going forward because if we don't know how much is coming from where, it's hard to figure out where to invest. And so I think that's a very important step that we're dealing with in our community, which naturally our member agencies don't want to have their meters put on their pipes. They want them on our pipes. So that's something we have to deal with. And you heard a great comment from Board Member Moore speaking as an engineer. So that's very, very important part of it. So any other comments or questions? If not, staff, thank you. And discharger, thank you. Board, staff's recommendation.
Yeah, just let me sum up.
Comments.
I appreciate that the board member comments indicate both understanding of staff's approach and support. So I like hearing that. I do want to point out that on page 21 of the tentative order, table 8 does include extensive tasks focused on blending, and as board member Brett pointed out, that really our focus is how can we address the flow issue, because that's really what it comes down to, and that really ties into all the actions you've taken over the past year to address the East Bay Mud Wet Weather facilities and the East Bay communities. And so this is going to be an ongoing process. Remember that these permits are reissued and considered for reissuance every 5 years, so there is an opportunity to revisit this. As Ben Ornstein said, there is a lot of national discussion in the papers, and that's trying to both incorporate the engineering advances, but also recognizing, as Board Member Moore did, that the monitoring really, in this case, we feel does not support pushing to do a very draconian restriction on blending. So it seems to have a place. I am sensitive to Vice Chair Young's concerns over waters to state. We want to make sure that there's a distinction here, that sometimes there's concern over spills that may, for instance, be a limited number of gallons that might get out of a manhole but then are contained in the gutter before they reach the storm drain. And we don't want to put in a big staff effort to try to oversee that in terms of enforcement, but we feel we do want to continue to push agencies to control any discharge that might reach what's quote-unquote this gap area of waters in the state versus waters in the U.S., and we feel we do have the ability under Porter Clone to pursue those. Even if it's not expressly pointed out, we have had times over the last few years where, through the State Board's development of the general waste discharge requirements for sanitary sewer overflows, to push this waters the state issue, and I think that's really, there is going to be an update of that order, and we'll continue to push it there to have a statewide approach of how we can address this in a consistent fashion. Because I will note, even in this case, really, East Bay Mud, as Robert's graphic pointed out, under this order, East Bay Mud only has about 40 miles of collection system, which is predominantly very large interceptors. And so we will know if there's a spill. And in fact, this board has fined East Bay Mud in the past few years for a spill from those interceptors. So as Dr. Young pointed out, it's not necessarily specific to this order, but it is an issue that we need to keep on the plate, and we support that. With that, I do recommend adoption of the tentative order you have in front of you. As noted, this is one of the largest discharges to the bay, very significant, but I think it's something that the board should be supporting.
I would move the staff recommendation.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliyahu?
Aye.
Mr.
McCoy? Aye.
Mr. Moore?
Aye.
Mr.
Peacock? Aye.
Aye.
Dr. Young?
Aye.
Mr. Muller?
Aye. So ordered, and thank everyone that's been involved in this process over the years. And so this time I'm going to request a quick break. A very quick break, and then we will get to our presentations today. Yeah. Okay. So we will be moving on to item 7, please.
Item 7 is an information item on the cleanup programs for the Department of Defense and Department of Energy. So I'd like Alec Noggle to give us the update on these programs.
Good morning, Chair Muller and members of the board. My name is Alec Noggle. I'm an engineering geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division. It's been several years since I've had the opportunity to speak to you directly, but I'm pleased to have this opportunity to present to you the accomplishments and status of the cleanup program for the Department of Defense and Department of Energy facilities. Before I begin, I just want to say a quick word about the use of acronyms, for which the Department of Defense is so well known. I'm going to endeavor to not use too many of them and not use the jargon, but I will refer to the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy as the DOD or DOE throughout my presentation, or more simply, the Defense and Energy Facilities. I'd like to give you a little background about the types and locations of the Defense and Energy Facilities undergoing cleanup in our region. This is a map showing a total of 40 defense facilities and 4 Department of Energy laboratories. The Navy bases here are shown in blue, the Army bases are shown in red, and the Air Force bases are shown in orange. You can see Travis Air Force Base up here. It's probably the largest Air Force base. The Department of Energy laboratories are in yellow. There are a few here. They're hard to make out. Here's one down here in Stanford, out in Livermore, and then in the Berkeley Hills, because they're generally much smaller than the defense facilities. The tan color, or this orange-yellow color, is a category called formerly used defense sites, or FUDs for short. FUDs are sites that were used by any branch of the military for usually for specific uses such as gun batteries, missile silos, and radar stations, typically associated with coastal defense. Some of the defense facilities that you're probably familiar with include the big Navy bases like the Mare Island Naval Shipyard up here in Vallejo, the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard in San Francisco, and the Alameda Point Naval Air Station in Alameda. Some of the Army facilities that you may be familiar with include the Hamilton Army Airfield in Novato and the Presidio of San Francisco. And of course, the Oakland Army Base here in Oakland. The 4 energy laboratories in our region include the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in the Berkeley Hills, the Lawrence Livermore and Sandia National Laboratories in Livermore, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center in the hills above the Stanford campus. One point I want to make about the defense facilities is that many of them, particularly the Navy bases, are located within historic baylands. The historic baylands are shown here as the green ringing both San Francisco and San Pablo Bays. That'll be more significant when I talk about wetlands restoration activities later. One of the main points I'd like to make today is the concept that defense and energy facilities are a lot like small cities. That's because many of them are large and complex with a range of pollution sources just like cities. Many of them include landfills, gas stations, and dry cleaners, and of course have leaky sewers and storm lines. As a result, they overlap with several of our regulatory programs.
What is privatized military?
Yes, I was just about to talk about that. There is a category called privatized military facilities. There are 2 in our region. These are basically facilities that have already been transferred back to civilian use and either are continuing to undergo cleanup or have been completely cleaned up. The 2 in our region that are listed here are the Presidio of San Francisco, which was transferred to the Presidio Trust and the National Park Service in 1994, and also a portion of the Mare Island Naval Station, which was transferred to the city of Vallejo in 2003 and is undergoing redevelopment by the Lennar Corporation.
What is the private housing of the community?
Although that's not put into this category because of funding, but it is still, it has been privatized there. So the table shows the different types of facilities. And the 3rd column is really where all the action is. This is the individual cleanup sites associated with the 44 defense and energy facilities. So again, in keeping with the city analogy, if the facilities are like small cities, these individual cleanup sites are all the individual gas stations, dry cleaners, landfills, and other cleanup sites that we have to address. So in all, there's 425 cleanup sites for 44 energy and defense facilities. And the column on the right indicates the federal funds that are provided to staff our cleanup program. These federal funds support 10 staff, along with two students and administrative support staff. Last year, the State Board tasked us to develop appropriate programmatic performance measures for the cleanup program. Site closures is an appropriate metric because it's something that we have a large degree of control over, as well as an important benchmark for site progress. Our annual goal is 40 site closures. This was developed largely based on looking at the 11-year period from 1999 through 2009. We had 480 site closures in that period, roughly about 44 per year. Currently at mid-year, we're at 19 site closures, so we think we're right on track to meet our annual goal of 40 for this year. Now I'd like to talk about some of the longer-term accomplishments that cover the past several years. This slide shows that there are currently 179 groundwater plumes at all the defense and energy facilities combined. Of these 179 plumes, the majority consists of chlorinated solvents or petroleum fuels. The chlorinated solvents are typically dry cleaner fluids or degreasers used for metal parts and engine cleaning. The most common fuel, petroleum fuels are gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Fortunately, the majority of the plumes, about 134 of them, or 75%, as shown in the left pie chart, are undergoing some form of remediation. The remaining 25%, or about 45 of those plumes, are still under investigation. The pie chart on the right shows that 82% of all the plumes are undergoing remediation, or 82% of all of the plumes that are undergoing remediation, about 110 of them, are either stable or decreasing in concentration or size. And on the other hand, about 18% of those plumes are increasing despite being under remediation. So this really points out that those 18% are, we want to make sure those become a priority. We estimate that there are about 40 groundwater plumes that threaten surface water quality, and this is largely because they're located along the bay margin, Navy bases, as I pointed out earlier, that tends to be where they're situated, where they can seep into the bay or marshland habitat. Currently, none of the plumes directly threaten drinking water supplies, and we think that's mainly because the bay and the tributary aren't used for drinking water, and groundwater in the bay margin tends to be generally as brackish and not used for drinking water supplies. So in a way, that's kind of luck of the draw. Another long-term accomplishment is the wetlands that have been created or restored, either at defense facilities or in association with them. As this slide indicates, a total of 650 acres of wetlands at defense facilities have been or are currently under restoration. To date, about 625 of those acres have been restored at the Hamilton Army Airfield, which is shown in these photos. The Hamilton Army Airfield is located in Nevada. Other wetland restorations have occurred at Crissy Field at San Francisco, at the Presidio of San Francisco, and at the former Mare Island Naval Shipyard in Vallejo. Now, the wetlands restoration at the Hamilton Army Airfield is part of the larger 2,600-acre congressionally authorized Hamilton Wetlands Restoration Project. The green area in the center photo shows the restoration activities at the former Army Airfield. In 2005, you adopted waste discharge requirements to regulate the beneficial reuse of dredge materials to facilitate the wetlands restoration and construction in this area. This gold area represents an area called the Belmarine Keys Unit 5, and that is the planned future restoration. It covers about 2,000 acres. As I mentioned, landfills are also an issue at most defense and energy facilities. There are 43 landfills that have been closed at all 44 defense and energy facilities combined, roughly about one landfill per facility. The accomplishment here is that all of the landfills are inactive and have either been closed or are going through the closure process. The main thing about landfill closure is that the landfill must be covered or capped, as this picture indicates here, so that no garbage or waste is exposed or reachable by most of the burrowing animals. The cover must also be sloped to promote lateral runoff of drainage so that stormwater is conveyed without contacting waste, and also so it doesn't erode the cover. This disclosed landfill is at the is also at the former Hamilton Army Airfield in Nevada. Another thing about closing landfills is that they usually require ongoing groundwater monitoring to ensure that the waste and any liquid or leachate that builds up inside the landfill don't degrade the water quality beyond the landfill limits. If it does, then cleanup may be necessary. Landfill closure may also include a collection system, such as the perimeter trenches that are shown here, in order to collect any gas or leachate or groundwater that may build up and seep out of the landfill so it could be properly disposed. The last long-term accomplishment I want to discuss is about the land that is cleaned up and made available for reuse at defense facilities. The safe reuse of former defense land is a major goal of the military, as well as all the federal, state, and local agencies that are involved. In many cases, once defense land is cleaned up, it's transferred to a local city for redevelopment. This usually includes mixed residential and commercial use, as well as open space uses, such as the wetland restoration and habitat preservation uses. Other uses include... In some cases, defense land is transferred to other branches of the military or not transferred at all. Those would be bases that are either going to continue to operate for a different branch of the military. What this slide shows is there are a total of 42,000 acres of defense land at all of the 44 facilities combined. That's roughly 65 square miles. Currently, about 18,000 acres, or about just under half, has been transferred back for civilian reuse. In the next 5 years, we estimate another 8,500 acres of land based on plans that have been submitted will be transferred. So that's a fair amount of, more than half of the total DoD land that will be reused. At this point, there are major transfers still to come at several closed military bases, for example, the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard, and more to come at the Treasure Island Naval Station. Let me again emphasize that land transfer and redevelopment is typically a deal between the Department of Defense and the local city. Our role, along with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the State Department of Toxic Substances Control, and other local agencies, is to make sure that the land is cleaned up for protection of water quality, human health, and the environment that is consistent with the city's reuse plan. Now I'd like to mention a few of the individual facility highlights with the cleanup of specific defense facilities. I selected these because I think these show some of the range of the more unique cleanup challenges that we face.
That's putting it mildly.
That's right. The first highlight I wanted to mention is the Presidio of San, as it happens at the Presidio of San Francisco, the Crissy Field restoration, which took place from 1994 through 2001. In 1994, the Presidio was transferred, as I mentioned, to the Park Service and formerly made part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. This was one of the earliest military base transfers. As part of the transfer agreement, the former 100-acre Crissy Field Army Landing Strip was targeted for restoration as a tidal marsh and open space park. Cleanup began in 1997. Restoration took place from 1998 through 2000. In the end, almost 90,000 tons of contaminated materials were removed, and 18 acres of the tidal marsh were created. In the words of the National Park Service, Crissy Field has been transformed from a derelict concrete wasteland to a well-trafficked public park. So the photos here show the before and after photo shots of what Crissy Field looked like, and also the grand opening in 2001. Those are kites, not seagulls, I believe. The second highlight is from the Moffett Field Naval Air Station in Mountain View. Moffett Field has been home to the iconic Hangar 1 since it was constructed in 1932 to house the giant airship, the USS Macon. Hangar 1 covers the equivalent of 10 football fields and is 200 feet tall. Environmental investigations revealed that the siding materials on the hangar actually contain polychlorinated biphenyls, also known as PCBs, as well as lead and zinc. Over time, these compounds had sloughed off and were transported through the facility's storm drain system into the storm drain retention pond, which is actually out in this area, I believe. as part of the cleanup plan, the Navy proposed, of course, to demolish the entire hangar and thereby get rid of the source. In 2009, the Navy reconsidered its demolition plan in light of the public's desire to preserve the hangar. Instead, the Navy finally agreed to remove the contaminated siding materials and then epoxy coat the framework, the steel framework. Instead, and that way it could be reused by another entity, and the current agreement appears to indicate that NASA will take that on, the reuse and the re-siding. The solution will preserve the hangar for future reuse as part of the NASA Ames Research Center, while at the same time it'll take care of the contaminant problem, source problems, so that the storm drain network and the stormwater retention pond can be cleaned up without fear of recontamination. The third highlight is from the Alameda Naval Air Station, also known as Alameda Point. In 2006, the Navy implemented an innovative groundwater cleanup technology called six-phase heating. And the point of that was to clean up a chlorinated solvent plume that existed beneath a six-acre building that had historically been used for aircraft maintenance. And because it was beneath the building, it wasn't amenable to most other cleanup technologies. So this six-phase heating technology requires insertion of steel rods into the ground to conduct an electrical current to heat up the subsurface. The goal is to raise the subsurface temperature to near the boiling temperature of water so that the contaminants will evaporate as steam. They also install vent wells within and surrounding this area to collect that steam and recondense the water and the contaminants for removal and disposal. Although the underground heating process is energy intensive, it's one of the few cleanup technologies that can achieve near complete contaminant removal in a relatively short time frame. And by that I mean within 2 to 3 years. Most cleanup technologies, subsurface and groundwater, can take 10 or more years, 10, 20 years, depending on what they're doing. At Alameda Point, 250 pounds of contaminants were removed in the 2 years from 2006 to 2008. And the monitoring data seem to indicate that the plume has been substantially reduced. We continue to monitor to see if there's any contaminant rebound. But so far, everything looks good.
Before you leave that, could you just comment briefly on seafloor and air? That was a big source of earlier.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with the individual facilities. I have to, so unfortunately I probably couldn't give you. You might know more about that than I do. The fourth highlight is from the Hunters Point Shipyard in San Francisco. In 2009, we signed 4 records of decision, which documented the cleanup approach for about 99 acres of land targeted for what we call early transfer back to the city of San Francisco, starting in 2011. This paves the way for the early transfer, which generally means that the city and its development partner will take responsibility for any future cleanup under an agreement with the Navy. We may or may not bring site cleanup requirements to you for consideration to essentially make sure that the city implements any needed cleanup. The city's reuse plan includes open space, mixed residential and commercial uses, and as well as educational and cultural uses. A portion of the land has been identified as a potential stadium site for the San Francisco 49ers. The Navy has committed to cleaning up all the remaining portions of the 936-acre facility, including some that will have natural shoreline restoration and the creation of 5 acres of tidal and seasonal wetlands. Once the cleanup is complete, that remaining portion will also be transferred to the city, but not as an early transfer. It'll be a complete cleanup. And the last highlight I want to mention comes from the Point Mulati Naval Fuel Depot in Richmond. The former Navy Fuel Depot is located on a peninsula in Richmond, just north of where the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge crosses the bay. In this photo, you can see a portion of the Chevron Richmond refinery up here, just to get your bearings. In 2003, 370 acres were transferred to the city of Richmond for redevelopment. We expect that the remaining 41 acres of this facility will transfer to the city later this year. This latest transfer is also an early transfer, which means that the city and its developer will assume responsibility for the remaining cleanup of those 41 acres. In November 2008, you adopted site cleanup requirements to ensure that the city and its developer do exactly that. As you can see, this photo, the Point Mulati land is prime real estate. The city of Richmond is currently conducting environmental review for its redevelopment plans, and it will almost certainly include some mix of commercial, residential, and open space uses. In closing, I'd like to acknowledge the staff of our Defense and Energy Cleanup Program. We intend to continue working hard to provide thorough regulatory oversight of these defense and energy facilities so that water quality, human health, and the environment will be protected, and that they can be restored and reused according to city cleanup plans. And on a personal note, I just want to say that these staff are some of the best and brightest that I've had the opportunity to work with. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Very good. I think Hunter's Point was in the paper this morning, again. Chronicle regarding locking up the developer's security guard or something with handcuffs to a post out there or some crazy thing, right?
It was in the EO report, too.
Yeah, that's right. And probably shouldn't even go there, but sadly, and we've all heard it and lived it, but first-hand knowledge of one cleanup site in the area that where an acquaintance of mine was superintendent on the construction project that was out to bid by a firm, and got there and the excavator was like at half throttle, and he told him, "What's this half throttle stuff?" And the guy goes, "That's what we have to do. We can stretch the job out that way." And he said, "No, throttle up and get a full scoop when you're digging. Don't give it this little half a scoop." And you know the horror stories of, "Oh, we need a generator. Well, buy two. Don't you need one at home?" You know, I mean, it's just horrible, horrible stuff. So let's call our U.S. representative on this one. So
difficult.
Anyway, thank you. Okay. Jim, you could fill us in on that seaplane deal, right? Someday? Quickly?
No. I'm just curious. It was, you know, the question there was, initially some of the studies had identified it as very high in PCBs, and maybe then it wasn't so high, and I'm just, you know, I've got smattering bits of knowledge, but no coherence, so. But it is nice to see these sites moving towards completion. And I would point out that one that I did have a significant part of my life wasn't even on there, and that was the Fleet Industrial Supply Center, Oakland, which is now a park, restored habitat, 5 container berths, and an intermodal. And just to give you some idea of the scale of that, I believe there were 32 million cubic yards of material, mostly clean, moved around, and because of the work of the Port of Oakland staff and consultants, something like only 30,000 cubic yards had to be hauled off-site. Most of it could be moved back far enough from the water. And the advantage of many of these old sites is they're underlaid by many, many feet of mud, which is a very effective aquaclude. So if you really contain it well, it's better off there than it is in many sanitary landfills. But our experience with the regional board staff on that, while not a picnic, was a very good one.
Yeah, and
I think it's worth noting that you know we don't see these action items before this board. This is some of the best work that's done in the agency. And, you know, I think it's worth just, you know, from the board's perspective, showing our support for your work. You know, some of the best talent, as you noted, is in this division because it takes a combination. You have to integrate a lot of technical disciplines, and then you have to, you know, get through some difficult interagency, multi-party processes. It takes a lot of patience and skill and talent. And the division's well-staffed, and the accomplishments speak to that. So, great work.
Thank you. I didn't want to bog you with those details, but that's exactly correct. Yes,
thank you. Thanks for showing us a picture of the staff, too. Yeah. It's a nice touch.
There will be a quiz. You can try to figure out who's been photoshopped into that photo.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't want to drag it out, but I know the Colonel could comment on. I mean, really, in the 60s and the 70s, not that long ago, we didn't really know better about what we were dumping and throwing around in the world. And we've really come a long way, considering what we've all been through. And I'm sure you could comment about a number of things we left behind that now we're sitting here trying to regulate. So,
well, there's a lot of lead out on the rifle ranges too. But one of the other points that I think really should be made here, and to the degree that on our website, or to the degree that in some of our press relations, that we can claim some of these great triumphs as well as the fines that we have put on to people who ignore our notices and ignore our letters and ignore, as we've seen in the last couple of hearings. I think positive stuff goes a long way, and it really will build greater support in the legislature for the mission that we have. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job. So I don't know the history of the military world down at that end of the table, but some of us that have been around a little longer. And actually, probably those things were happening when most board members weren't even born yet. That's what's scary. We're sitting here talking about. So, okay, we're moving on. Thank you, staff, for that presentation. Moving on to our last item, and our state board staff is here to make us a brief presentation, correct?
Yeah.
Reed, nice seeing you again.
Reed Sato's come down from Sacramento to update us on the water quality enforcement policy, and he's got a handout using large font. So
okay. Nice seeing you, Reed, Sacramento. Thank you for the presentation. Go easy on us, buddy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the board, regional board staff, good morning. I'm Reed Sato with the State Water Resources Control Board Office of Enforcement. And thank you for the opportunity to come here today and brief you and update you on the new water quality enforcement policy and the supplemental environmental project policy. I'm not going to dim the lights because, you know, I handed you a copy of my PowerPoint presentation. I don't have any interesting pictures like the last one, so probably just need to watch me and see me present this information. In 2002, the water quality enforcement policy was adopted by the state board. And at the time that the policy was adopted, it was contemplated that the policy would be updated about every 5 years. And so in 2007, the Office of Enforcement began the process of trying to update the existing 2002 version. Now, we had numerous staff workshops. We had several state board workshops on the issue. We had lots of stakeholder meetings, also with the regional boards and with the regulated community. We finally even convened what we called an executive steering committee made up of high-level members of both the state board and two executive officers from the regional boards, including Bruce Wolf from this region, to get a lot of really good input and guidance as to how we really wanted to design our water quality enforcement policy. And so finally, in November of 2009, this policy was adopted by the state board. It has to now be approved by the Office of Administrative Law before it is considered to be effective and controlling. With regard to the Supplemental Environmental Project Policy, that policy started off as part of the Water Quality Enforcement Policy, but for a variety of reasons got cleaved off and was considered separately by the State Board. And the State Board adopted that policy in 2009. It was approved by the Office of Administrative Law in September of 2009, so is, in fact, an effective controlling policy for the water boards. So first of all, I just want to talk about the water quality enforcement policy that was adopted in November of 2009. Oops. How do I move this forward? Great. All right. So let's talk about the goals of the water quality enforcement policy. First of all, you know, as this administration has emphasized on enforcement, they want to be fair, firm, and tough when it comes to enforcement. What we wanted to do with those basic principles is overlay a few other things, which is to increase consistency, accountability, and transparency in the way that the water boards conducted their enforcement activities. And as we go through some of the issues related to the water quality enforcement policy, I hope to come back and illustrate how those themes were addressed. Secondly, this policy is designed really to be a policy statement. If you look at our 2002 enforcement policy, it is very large. It has a lot of guidance. It has a lot of mays, shoulds, things of that nature. What we wanted to do is to try to confine this to be much more of a policy directive, a prescriptive document, so that people could clearly see what it is that the state board wanted to see happen. There's still a few shoulds, but it's been substantially reduced. Finally, it is an enforcement policy, so we really tried to focus on enforcement. That is, activities that the water boards would take once we detected a violation of our water quality laws. So we don't talk very much at all about compliance assistance or compliance inspections or other aspects that may have been in the prior policy. This is purely about what we do after we detect the violation. So the significantly revised visions of the enforcement policy are set forth in this next slide, and I'm going to try to touch on each of them for you. So first of all, one of the changes we made was on facilities serving small communities with financial hardships. And I understand from your staff here that you don't have very many of these communities in your region. And so I will just say that what we did here was try to make sure that we address small communities in our enforcement policy in a manner consistent with the way that we did small community wastewater strategy. So it's just designed to be a consistency issue. Now, moving on to the next slide, we're talking about enforcement priorities for discretionary enforcement actions. Under the existing 2002 version of our policy, we do have a prioritization scheme for violations, which is basically that every violation of the water code is a priority for the water boards. And so, as a result, you know, we have really no prioritization scheme in terms of differentiating between one type of violation or another. So what we did in the new policy was came up with a framework for prioritizing violations. We got three categories or three classes, and the criteria is based upon basically threat to human health, water quality, or the integrity of the regulatory program. Let me just skip forward here. So if you look at the next slide, you can see the three classes of violations summarized, and you can see kind of the stepwise process where we went from class one to class two to class three. You know, with regard to threats, immediate threat is a class 1, class 2 is a moderate threat, class 3 is a minor threat, and the same thing holds true in terms of the effect on the regulatory program. How do I go back? All right. And so, why are we prioritizing these types of violations for, you know, our work? Well, a couple of things. It's several things, actually. First of all, we have limited enforcement resources, and so it is clear that we probably should try to devote those limited resources to the violations that create the greatest threats to human health, water quality, or our regulatory program. Secondly, there are a lot of violations that we do not get to. In our annual enforcement report, we show thousands of violations that we are unable to address, that are recorded in our database system, but we have not been able to take a formal enforcement action, or perhaps any enforcement action. We need to explain to the regulated community and the public what exactly those violations are that we are not able to get to. So we thought that this prioritization framework will help explain that. And third, you know, we have some of our enforcement priorities dictated to us by the legislature. You may be aware that of the mandatory minimum penalty program, that the legislature wants us to take enforcement action against certain specified types of violations. Well, the question is, of course, are those specified violations really the greatest threats to human health, water quality, or our regulatory program? And we think that if we collect information about what we're faced with, it might help us in the dialogue that we would have with the legislature if we want to discuss with them any amendments or changes to that mandatory minimum penalty structure. So after we look at prioritizing violations, then we want to talk about, well, how do we then decide which of those violations we really want to target for formal enforcement action. And then at that point, we want to look at the characteristics of the discharger to try to look at that particular entity or individual and see what information we can glean about that person. At the same time, we also want to look at the resources that we have within the individual regional boards. You know, how many enforcement resources do we have at a specific time? Do we want to really take this one on as a formal enforcement action, or are we so limited in our resources because we're tied up with doing so many other Class 1 violations that we perhaps can't get to this one either? So it's a kind of a prioritization scheme here. Finally, you know, we are coming up with the idea that we would have more prioritization activities taking place within the regional boards. And I know that this region now has embarked on a process from the staff perspective to start trying to have regular enforcement prioritization meetings to think about the cases they have in front of them to see how they stack up for particular formal enforcement actions. We think that's a good idea. We're encouraging that. The policy kind of demands that from each of the regions as we go forward. In addition, we're hoping to identify annual enforcement priorities both at the state board level and at the regional level, so that the public can know what exactly it is that we are targeting for our upcoming enforcement activities. And finally, there's a bullet here that says that we're going to try to have an automated violation prioritization by 2012. That's something that the Division of Water Quality has promised to help the regional staff work on these three classes, and so hopefully that's something they will produce.
What does that mean? I mean, does that mean we have an automated record of our priorities, or we have
the idea of a formula
that spits out our priorities for us?
Yes. The idea was that they would, not necessarily kicks out your priorities, but will help with the prioritization system. I mean, this is something that the engineers are proposing, and based upon an algorithm that they would develop. I just wanted to mention, because it's in the policy, I actually don't know how this is actually going to happen.
Don't mention it then.
Well, your staff is very interested in hearing that this is going
to
happen.
You're getting raised eyebrows if you're, you know, if you want to send feedback back to the state board.
Hi, Emma, are you still in the room?
All right, moving on to the next slide, we're talking about the state board taking enforcement action. A number of groups were interested in the fact, or are aware of the fact, that the state board has jurisdiction and authority to take on a number of the environmental matters that are traditionally have been left to the regional boards to undertake. And so they wanted the state board to articulate the process by which it would take enforcement actions on its own. And so we have listed in the policy, the circumstances, and the situations in which that may take place. My belief is that even though we've articulated these policies or this set of criteria, that it will basically be as is currently, which is we will consult with the regional boards, we will discuss with the regional boards whether it makes sense for the state board to become involved or to take over a particular enforcement action, and that's pretty much the way it will happen. I want to talk about monetary assessments and administrative civil liabilities at the administrative level, because this is probably the area that caused the policy to keep it from being adopted, you know, much, much earlier. So first of all, let me just talk about the goals, because the goals aren't the things that caused the delay in our adoption. Fair and consistent liability amounts, not much dispute about that. We wanted to fully eliminate any economic or competitive disadvantage obtained from noncompliance. As you may be aware, in some of the statutes in the Water Code, the recovery of economic benefit is a requirement of a particular penalty scheme, but it's not in all of these statutory penalty schemes. The State Board said, for all of the schemes, as a matter of policy, we think we ought to recover economic or competitive advantage from our liability assessments. Relationship to the gravity of the violation, the harm to the beneficiary uses, the integrity of the regulatory programs, again, that goes without saying. And finally, we wanted to have a developed policy and a penalty assessment scheme that deterred future violations, both for the violator and for the discharger community. And, you know, as an example of that, I like to point this to what Region 6 did recently in one of their administrative liability actions. What they did was they doubled a penalty that was recommended to them by their enforcement staff for a violation of a cleanup and abatement order. And they doubled back and they put out a press release. And they said specifically, we want to let the regulated community know that if you violate one of our cleanup and abatement orders, there's going to be a significant penalty to be paid if we find you in violation. So that, we thought that was, you know, the kind of sensibility that is embodied within this policy. I also want to tell you, too, that on the state board level, we recently brought an enforcement action against the city of Long Beach for underground storage tank violations, and we obtained a judgment against them for $6.2 million, of which $1.7 million they had to pay immediately to the cleanup and abatement account. You know, we assessed that liability, even though the city told us they had a $40 million deficit in their budget. But the kinds of violations that they had engaged in were so significant that we thought it was important for us to let that city know and other entities that had similar types of violations that there were going to be real and substantial consequences if you violated the law. So that's the sensibility about addressing both the violator and sending a message to the regulated community. So I can see that what happened here was that I had a slide that would have talked about the penalty methodology scheme. And I wasn't going to go through the whole penalty methodology scheme for you. But
you.
What we wanted to let you know is that there is a stepwise process that this methodology has come up with. And it's both to deal with both discharge situations and non-discharge situations. And basically any penalty scheme or penalty system under the water code that we would apply, we wanted this methodology to go through. And what it does is it tries to address all of the statutory requirements that you folks would be faced with in terms of leveling an appropriate administrative civil liability. Now, what did we want to do here? First of all, the main goal in trying to come up with this methodology was consistency. Consistency between the regional boards. You know, there's a great deal of complaint that the state board got was that from one regional board to another regional board, they assessed administrative civil liability in much different ways. And so we tried to address that complaint. Secondly, people felt that there wasn't very much transparency in the way that the administrative civil liabilities were being assessed. And so by use of the methodology, we think that addresses the issue of transparency. I mean, if the staff comes to you and recommends a particular civil liability, there's a process that they should have gone through. There is an evidence trail that they should be able to present to you that justifies that particular recommended liability. Similarly, though, if you folks decide you want to change that liability, either up or down, we expect you also to go through the methodology and be able to show transparently how those changes were. What we're trying to do is get away from the idea that administrative civil liability, at least in the water code world, is based upon some kind of gut reaction, seat of the pants, whim, or you know, some special thing that only regulatory staff are able to divine. So we think this is going to be a much better process in the long run. We want everybody to use the methodology, we want to emphasize that the standard of review is still, you know, your decision about what the appropriate penalty will be sustained as long as there's no abuse of discretion, mistake of material fact, or mistake in law. So, and finally, because there was some concern about how this methodology might be used or whether or not there were some unforeseen consequences from the adoption of this methodology, the state board staff, my office, was directed to report back to the state board after 2 years of the adoption of the policy and tell them how it was going in terms of the use of this methodology for the calculation of penalties. So let me turn now to mandatory minimum penalties. That is a section under the Water Code 13.35 that for certain types of violations that there be a $3,000 liability assessed at a minimum. We've been criticized quite a bit for having a large backlog of mandatory minimum penalty violations that have not been resolved. And so the state board had issued a statement that these things be resolved within 18 months from the issue, from the discovery of the violation. Now, I can tell you that under the existing policy, there was a directive that they be resolved within 7 months of discovery, and that simply didn't work. And so 18 months is what the State Board has picked now. But I can tell you that this is one of the shoulds as opposed to a shall. This is a recommendation as opposed to a hard requirement. In addition, they want to expedite these mandatory minimum penalties when it either deals with a small community with financial hardship or when the proposed penalty is greater than $30,000. I mean, one of the problems that we had in trying to deal with our backlog of mandatory minimum penalty cases is that because we hadn't contacted a discharger for some period of time, the penalties, you know, turned out to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars and created a huge hardship for that discharger in order to try to resolve that with the State Board. So we're trying to make sure that if we do this in a more timely way, that it reduces the impact of the penalty on that discharger. But at the same time, you know, it has the effect of notifying that discharger of what the problems are. Finally, we've got policy statements defining a discharge monitoring report in special circumstances. This is more of a legal issue that I won't bore you with, but it will somewhat reduce the burden of the mandatory minimum penalty on the discharger community when it comes to reporting issues. Mandatory minimum penalties for POTWs serving a small community. I understand that you folks don't do that, so I'm going to skip through this one. Compliance projects. So this next slide is a little bit confusing, but what we were trying to do here was to emphasize the idea that in the mandatory minimum penalties world, there is the opportunity for POTW serving small communities, small disadvantaged communities, to offset the payment of penalties by performing what's called a compliance project. That is, if they've been in violation of the law, there are certain things we would allow them to undertake projects to fix those violations in lieu of paying penalties. So that's the scheme by statute. What we said by policy is that only in those areas that are authorized by statute can that occur. That is, the undertaking of projects to bring your facility into compliance with the law as an excuse to pay penalties or as an offset of penalties. That previously was in the former policy. The State Board decided that they wanted to ratchet that down and only put it in areas in which the compliance project scheme was expressly authorized by law. And so we have some requirements now to clarify how compliance projects can be utilized. But since these only apply to small communities, small disadvantaged communities, and you don't have any here, I will skip through this as well. So enhanced compliance actions. Now, enhanced compliance actions are a little bit different than compliance projects. Enhanced compliance actions are something that were recognized in the existing policy, and we wanted to make sure that people understood that they were still available under the new policy. And that those are things where a discharger wants to undertake a project or action beyond what is required by law. And so the example I always like to use is like in the underground storage tank situation. If somebody has a single-walled tank, if they said, well, look, in lieu of paying some penalties for you, we'll agree to double wall all of our tanks, even though we're not required to by law. That's the kind of project that would be considered a quote-unquote enhanced compliance project. Or in the situation like in with the city of Long Beach that I mentioned previously, they came up with an environmental management scheme that was much more complex than anything that they had tried before, but designed to improve their ability to comply with the law, and we gave them some credit against what otherwise would be a penalty for the implementation of that type of activity. So we have enhanced compliance actions still available. Violation enforcement data. This is something that probably applies more to your staff than you folks, but you know, this is an organization that really wants to make decisions based upon data, information, not anecdote. So it's really important for us to get data into our various systems that we rely upon. And so we want the staff to enter violation data within 10 days of discovery. We want them to enter enforcement actions within 20 days of discovery, because we have these reporting requirements that we make to the legislature. And it's always difficult to be able to make these reports to either the legislature or the public if the data isn't fresh. Finally, and we're looking at the idea of having every enforcement action track a discharger's return to compliance. So we want to know, if we're doing some action, let's make sure that we know that that action has caused the discharger to address the violation that we've brought to their attention. And previously, our data system didn't do that. Now we want our data system to do that. And finally, we have something on ACL public noticing requirements. The big change here was that the issuance of the ACLs under 13385, that is to enforce under what otherwise would be the Clean Water Act, no longer requires newspaper publication, but we can post those on our respective web pages. So we think that we'll get the same public notification, but at much reduced cost to the water boards. Finally, enforcement reporting and performance measures. The policy just lists all of the legislatively mandated and elective enforcement reports, and we have quite a few of them. And then we also highlight the performance measures that the State Board wants to utilize for the enforcement program. And those performance measures are the same ones that we've been highlighting in our various enforcement reports over the last several years. Now I'm going to turn briefly to the supplemental environmental projects, and I got about, I'd say, 5 more minutes on this subject. So the supplemental environmental project policy had several goals here. One, it wanted to continue to allow the use of supplemental environmental projects, SEPs, while ensuring that there was a reasonable portion of the money would go towards statewide funds established by the legislature. We also wanted, and here's the idea of accountability, we wanted to require greater accountability for those who engaged in supplemental environmental projects, and we wanted to address the Legislative Analyst Office's concerns regarding the Water Board's use of SEPs. And so what are those LAO concerns? One was that the use of SEPs reduced funding available for statewide projects, and by statewide projects, I'm assuming that what they were concerned about is that there was not a sufficient amount of money potentially going into accounts managed for statewide projects like the Clean Water Abatement Account or the Waste Discharge Permit Fund. Second issue they raised was that the regions regularly permitted SEPs in excess of 50% of the total monetary value of the assessed liability. They wanted the State Water Board to have a greater role in SEP fiscal oversight. They wanted to make sure that SEP data, information about what projects were being addressed or funded with these monies was available and available to the public. And finally, they were concerned about the use of trust funds to hold funds for future SEPs. A couple of the regions had basically not actually established projects with their SEP money, but had kind of put them in a special account which they would utilize for some future activity. And that was considered to be an area of great concern to the LAM. So to summarize the SEP policy revisions, what we did was we limited the amount of the SEP now to 50% relative to the overall monetary assessment. And so it says after repayment of enforcement costs. Let me just briefly say how that would work. Let's say we have what would otherwise be a resolution of $100,000 for an administrative civil liability action. And to reach that $100,000 resolution, we had $20,000 worth of staff enforcement costs. So first you take the $20,000 of staff enforcement costs, because this is a settlement, we take out the $20,000 of staff enforcement costs, we have $80,000 left over. So the maximum amount of the SEP in that situation would be $40,000, or the value of the SEP would be $40,000. Now the 50% limit can be exceeded if there's compelling justification, and I'll talk about what compelling justification is in just a moment. It prevents the creation of SEP accounts managed independently of the State Board without express approval. So those kind of trust fund accounts that I talked about or that the LAO was particularly concerned about, that won't happen at the regional level unless the State Board expressly concurs with that type of fund or account. And it provides that SEPs can and should be audited. In other words, to anybody who performs a SEP has to be aware that we may require that their activities be audited to make sure that the money that they say they were spending on a SEP project is in fact spent on the SEP project. The cost of the Water Board oversight, if any, of the SEP is not really included in the value of the SEP unless expressly approved by the Water Board. So in my example, when I talked about a $40,000 SEP, if your staff says, well, we estimate that our oversight costs are going to be $5,000, we would expect that the regional board in accepting that SEP would say to the discharger, okay, we can allow you to do this SEP for $40,000, but there's an additional $5,000 that you will also be liable for because we need to cover the cost of our oversight. However, you have the option of saying, look, we'll just eat those oversight costs and we'll put it in the value of the SEP. But we want people to be cognizant of the fact that SEPs cost the water board's money. And so, you know, if you're going to accept a SEP, you need to be aware of the whole financial burden caused by that acceptance. We want discharges to pay for SEP oversight, including, so that's just another element of what I just talked about. And finally, we want the SEPs to be fully completed before the discharger satisfies its obligation. So in the past, sometimes we said, discharger X, you know, in resolution of your liability for a SEP, you can pay X number of dollars over to, you know, Good Works X. And by paying that money over, that's relieved your obligation under the administrative civil liability. That's not going to be the case anymore. What we want to do is that if somebody says they're going to give money to Good Works X to do a project, we want Good Works X to actually complete that project. And we want the discharger to be on the hook to make sure that that third party completes the project before we say that that discharger has fulfilled their obligation. What we found is that there, over the past, sometimes people have given money to these third parties with all good intentions, but for whatever reason, the money was never spent or the money wasn't spent properly. We refined the list of SEPs to emphasize the nexus requirement and to propose SEPs that enhance compliance or remedy adverse impacts from the violations. I think that seems like a fairly obvious thing to do with supplemental environmental projects. And then it creates annual reporting obligations for the water boards regarding the status of SEPs. So my last slides just here deal with the criteria for evaluating a SEP in excess of 50%. What happened was that when this policy was brought before the State Water Board, originally the proposal from staff was that the State Board could decide on a case-by-case basis whether there should be the allowance of a SEP in excess of 50%. And the State Board decided that they did not want to deal with that on themselves, that they delegated that authority to the Director of the Office of Enforcement, so that would be me. And so what we did was we came up with some factors that we have provided to all the enforcement staff and your enforcement coordinators about what we would consider in terms of whether we would go over the 50%. But I got to tell you, now the 50% limit is fairly generous when you contrast it to other enforcement policies. For example, Cal EPA's enforcement policy has a 25% cap on SEPs. Most of the air districts and the air boards have a 25% limit on, or cap on SEPs. So, you know, just to want to show you where you folks are relative to those other environmental protection agencies. So anyway, we have a number of factors. I'm not going to go through all of them because your staff has them. But I want to just emphasize to you that we will always consider whatever factors your staff wants to bring to us in arguing or advocating for a supplemental environmental project in excess of 50%, and we'll give that a fair audience and consideration. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you on these subjects.
Thank you, Reid. Steve, questions? Do you have quick comments?
Questions?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, our... You know, I commend you for coming into the lion's den about that comments about supplemental environmental projects, because that's something we think has a long track record of success here in this region. And I'm a strong advocate of having no cap. So I want to, you know, thank you for giving your rationale, and I'll continue to respectfully disagree. The trust fund concept, I wanted to ask about that, because in your tone, you really kind of had a dismissive tone about the concept. And the thing is, to really accomplish water quality gains, you have to be creative in terms of getting funding together. And this is a great way, you know, to get funding to do amazing things that are not possible on a case-by-case basis. And I was wondering, on the subject of setting up funds to accomplish large-scale, you know, wetland or river restoration projects, Are you familiar with the Fish and Game Small Spills Fund?
I'm familiar with a lot of different funds. In fact, I've even created special funds.
In terms of that fund, my specific question is, well, what's your opinion of it and its functioning, and what are some of the problems with it?
Well, you know, I mean, there you've got funds created controlled by a particular organization. You have right now the Cleanup and Abatement Account, which is where most penalty monies are supposed to go by statute. The Cleanup and Abatement Account is an environmental restoration fund. It is simply controlled by the state board as opposed to one of the regional boards. You know, so I think that the legislature has already decided that it wanted to create a trust fund concept or a repository for penalty money that is derived from enforcement actions, and they decided it would be, for a lot of the work, either the Cleanup and Abatement Account, and for a lesser number of the cases, for the Waste Discharge Permit Fund. You know, I think what the board was trying to get to here was something that really wasn't something that we were advocating from an enforcement side, but more from the administrative financial side, was that they didn't want a bunch of accounts floating around out in the regions, particularly after the criticism that we received from the Legislative Analyst Office. I mean, if we hadn't addressed this in policy, they would have probably passed a statute that would have otherwise constrained us as well. So I think the concern that was addressed by that particular trust fund issue was to not prevent the regions from doing that, but do it in a way that they work with the state board, administrative, and financial folks to make sure that that was something that met their requirements as well.
And I'd add to that we don't want to, at our level, have to try to manage those type of funds. We've had bad experiences dating back to experience I had with a landfill that set aside $125,000 for mitigation, and we couldn't find a place to use that, but we had to still sort of manage it. Why am I, as an engineer, trying to manage, you know, what we're doing with $125,000? So from that perspective, we fully agree. We don't want to have some of these. We want to have the project, by and large, identified. But I think your point also is, how can we, if we have small funds or small pots of money from an enforcement action here and here, how can we cobble them together? And we agree we should look at that and see from a staff level, are there things we can pull together, but we'd rather have that pulled together and then boom, into a project, rather than somebody saying, gee, we'll set aside $25,000 for a restoration when we might not know when that restoration is going to be.
And that's a point we're taking. You know, there has to be staff support, obviously, and you know that there's something that has legs. And then, obviously, you need to be able to defend it. This is something that in a certain time frame, it will get done. So
I guess the other part is, as Reed says, is the money that goes into the cleanup and abatement account is available for projects statewide. And your approval of the request for Rambaroo Island restoration a few months ago is an example of that. We need to be bringing things to you that make sense in terms of how we can apply cleanup abatement funds within our region.
My quick comment would be that I hope I'm totally wrong, but there's a lot of small underserved communities that soon will be not so small underserved communities the way California's going. In other words, some mid-sized cities are going to be struggling for underserved status, let me tell you.
I do understand that there's a bill out to change the definition. Right now it's based on 10,000. This would increase to 20,000. Mm-hmm. And also, this is something we're going to look at again, because Dorothy Vicky was pointing out to me that while we've commonly dismissed the availability of small community funding and applicability in our region because of income requirements, there's also now a 10% unemployment level, and that may very well apply to various communities.
And just quickly, I mean, you talk in San Bruno Pacifica in our region here that are some major fines, and let me tell you, they're going to have a tough time.
Yeah. So we're going to look at that, but some of this is already established as to what the definition is, and historically we found that not only our region, but to a certain degree, the coastal regions largely don't have communities that qualify because of the property value, and secondarily then the income, you know, so that the bulk of those communities might be some of the smaller communities in Central Valley.
I just happened to think of this. What about unincorporated communities? You know, that they're in a big populous area, but there's a lot of pockets that are unincorporated.
Right, right. And I think there are some limitations on how that applies. We in the past have looked at areas like Port Costa or the town of Tamales and some of these to see how we might fit it in there. And it's there's limited wiggle room in there.
Thank you.
Let me just say, Mr. Chair, in light of that question, I'm sorry I brushed over that because I thought there wasn't any small communities in this jurisdiction. But if there are, what the policy does is it has now delegated to the regional boards the ability to make certain determinations about whether or not you're dealing with a POTW serving a small community with financial hardship. So to the extent that things are based upon, these are residential fee-based POTWs, you will be able to make that determination within certain constraints provided for by the law. It is a delegation from the state board to the regional boards to make that determination.
Good. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Somehow it slipped in there, and I didn't see where it came from. Who determined 50% versus 40% versus 75%? Who made that determination?
I think the state board did.
State board did.
Okay. If there's no further questions to read, thank you for this lengthy, and this is definitely something we can save and keep because I think a number of these board members have talked about these items, particularly on follow-up and consistency and things like that. So,
thank you.
Thank you very much. And that concludes the business session. We have no closed session today.
Correct.